price that's paid when, as in Ireland until recently, the church dominates the state.
To compensate for being poor and for being underdeveloped, Ireland had created this myth of itself as the most Catholic country in the world, the sort of spiritual richness that somehow was supposed to compensate for material poverty. And that was all very well. And of course, there were very strong reasons of history why the Catholic Church was just so dominant in Ireland. It had been around a hell of a long time, longer than the state. So, you know, for the majority in Ireland, the faith, you know, was not just a religion, it was a matter of national identity as well. And that's not a great combination. I mean, religion and politics are very important things in and of themselves, but when you fuse them into a single identity, it actually becomes pretty toxic. And so somebody has to pay the price to keep a country with this self-image of being, you know, exceptionally holy. And the price, as you know, is almost always paid by women.
That's Fintan O'Toole. We talk with him about his scathing and tender personal history of modern Ireland. We don't know ourselves. Then we hear Seamus Heaney reading a poem and a rare recording of Susan Porter, storyteller of Big Sur, reading from the Irish legend of Cuchulainn. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When Fintan O'Toole was born in 1958, Ireland was perhaps the poorest country in Europe. Most of its people scrabbled out a meager living on the land. The country's main export, aside from cattle, was its own youth. Facing bleak prospects at home, young people fled abroad to England, America, and elsewhere in droves. Ireland was also in the grip of what can only be described as a theocracy. The Catholic Church ruled over the most intimate aspects of people's lives, the family, reproduction, sexuality, education, and health care. Anything that violated the strict dictates of the Church was severely punished, except, of course, for the pedophilia rampant among the priesthood, which was ignored. Corruption reigned in both church and state. Now Ireland is a global center for the technology and pharmaceutical industries. Abortion and gay marriage are legal. The gender apartheid that reigned of old has been overturned. Much has changed, although the Irish Tigers' neoliberalism hasn't put an end to corruption. It's just altered the playing fields. As a journalist and critic for the Irish Times since 1988, Fintan O'Toole has had a front-row seat on Ireland's cultural, political, and economic transformation. His best-selling book, We Don't Know Ourselves, A Personal History of Modern Ireland, is unsparing in its critique of those who ruled the country. But it's a critique founded on a profound love for his long-beleaguered compatriots. And O'Toole draws a cautionary lesson for us here in the U.S. as the lines separating church and state become ever more eroded. Fintan O'Toole is a columnist for the Irish Times and teaches at Princeton University. He was drama critic for the New York Daily News and is a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books.
Oh, thank you so much, Francesca. It's lovely to be with you.
This book, We Don't Know Ourselves, A Personal History of Modern Ireland. First, I want to ask you about the subtitle. Let's start with that personal. Tell us a little bit about your own background growing up with working class parents, yet with opportunities they never had, and how your story intersects with the story of modern Ireland.
So I was born in 1958, which, apart from my birth, was a very significant year in Ireland, because it was a year in which really government policy changed very radically for reasons that we might want to talk about a little bit in some detail. But effectively, the Ireland I was born into was backward economically. It was poor, very underdeveloped, and lots of people were leaving. The particularly harsh thing was that they were going to England. So, which of course was the country that Ireland had freed itself from over 30 years before. So, you know, my father's family, I mean, nearly all his siblings were in England by the time that I was born, you know, and that was not untypical. So my parents as well had both left school before high school. So they didn't get to high school at all. I think my father was 13 when he left school. My mother was 14. And again, that was not untypical either. You know, people think of Ireland as a great center of scholarship and learning and art, and it is. But most people actually had very little access to education. And this process of change that got underway in 1958, I was very lucky in that it sort of had reached a point 10 years later where, and this might seem kind of ridiculous to American listeners, you know, that one of the big government policy changes was to make high school education free. So before that, almost all the second level schools were run by the Catholic Church, and the church charged fees. So you had to pay quite a lot of money to go to school. And most working class families just couldn't afford to do that. So it's made me someone who's actually very enthusiastic about political change. You know, I'm not somebody who, you know, is sort of skeptical about what governments can do, because that change really changed my life. I mean, I wouldn't be talking to you. I probably wouldn't have ever written a book. I wouldn't have had the career that I've had if Ireland hadn't started to transform itself in that period. And to understand that a big part of that transformation had to be access to education.
Transformation, yes, but on another track, very much staying the same. This memoir of Ireland, of modern Ireland, and your personal history of it is unsparing. It's loving, but unsparing, a trenchant critique of your native land as it went from the poorest to one of the more developed countries in Europe over the span of some 50 years. A central theme that runs through the book is what you call the unknown knowns, the dual faces of Ireland between myth and reality, what everybody knew but nobody said, the ways in which it was changing, but the ways in which it stayed ever so much the same. Talk about that cognitive dissonance that you say is so deeply ingrained in Irish society.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you could argue that most societies have some form of this, but I think it was particularly deep in Ireland. I think for a couple of reasons. I mean, one was mass emigration. You know, it's a very strange culture, I think, when you know that you're raising your kids for export, you know, and we have to remember that for most of this history of mass migration, when somebody left, they were gone. You know, if they went to America, it's very likely you'd never see them again. And this also produced a weird kind of contradiction. So Irish people were modernizing themselves in the very radical ways of you know, going from a little farm in the west of Ireland. They weren't going to a little farm in Kentucky or Minnesota. I mean, they were going to New York, to Boston, to Chicago. They were going to English cities. They, you know, so we actually, if you just say, well, what's Ireland? If it's the people had been experiencing this sort of existence of an urban industrial world for a very long time. But the country, the place, was keeping all of that out, keeping it at bay. So you had this kind of strange contradiction really between the people and the place. The place was intensely conservative, very agricultural. The economy was dominated really by cattle. In some ways, in the 1950s, Ireland was a giant cattle ranch, you know, and the cattle were exported to England. And often the people were on the same boats as the cattle. I mean, it was an image that, you know, created a lot of bitterness in the minds of ordinary Irish people, you know, the idea that our young people were exported with the cows, you know. So that was one form of this sort of doubleness. And the other one was that to compensate for being poor and for being underdeveloped, Ireland had created this myth of itself as the most Catholic country in the world. You know, the sort of spiritual richness that somehow was supposed to compensate for material poverty. And I mean, that was all very well. And of course, there were very strong reasons of history why the Catholic Church was just so dominant in Ireland. It had been around a hell of a long time, longer than the state. And because of all the struggles against the British, you know, Catholicism was associated with Irishness, Protestantism with Britishness. And so, you know, for the majority in Ireland, the faith, you know, was not just a religion, it was a matter of national identity as well. And that's not a great combination. I mean, religion and politics are very important things in and of themselves, but when you fuse them into a single identity, it actually becomes pretty toxic. And so somebody has to pay the price to keep a country with this self-image of being, you know, exceptionally holy. And the price, as you know, is almost always paid by women. It was women who had to uphold this virtue, and they had to uphold it through terror, to be quite frank. You know, the fear of getting pregnant outside of marriage was an overwhelming reality for most Irish women. And this wasn't abstract. You know, there were these institutions, Magdalene laundries, where, you know, young women who were judged to be a moral danger were incarcerated. I mean, they were just taken from home, put into these institutions run by nuns, made to do laundry. These were commercial laundries, essentially slave labor. And in many cases, they never got out. I mean, some of them became institutionalized and spent their lives in these institutions. There were institutions called mother and baby homes, where, again, if a young woman became pregnant out of wedlock, she was just taken. She was given a number rather than a name. She had her baby. Again, these institutions run by nuns. And she signed away the baby straight away, you know, and then, you know, came out of this sort of secret world as if nothing had happened. And of course, that's huge psychological costs, you know, that we're only now really engaging with so many of the women who had this experience. Often these babies were effectively sold to Americans. I mean, I know people will be listening to me and saying that just sounds completely crazy, but it is what happened. And particularly in the 1950s and 1960s, there was a big demand for Irish babies from American Catholic couples, bluntly, because they were white. A lot of the babies that were available for adoption in America were children of color. And so there was this demand, you know, because you could get a white baby in Ireland. And in some cases, you could say it was your own child. The Irish authorities often colluded to have the birth certificates changed so that the adoptive couple seemed to be the natural parents of the kid. And in return, basically, you gave a large donation to the nuns, you know, to the convent or whatever. So again, these were institutions that, and there were horrible institutions for children as well, called industrial schools. And everybody knew all this stuff, you know, it was there. I mean, they weren't on an island somewhere off the West Coast. You know, there were, like, I talked about these Magdalene laundries. I mean, the last Magdalene laundry closed in 1994, I think. I mean, and it's right in the heart of Dublin, you know, in the capital city. It's It's about 5 minutes walk away from the at the dead center of the city, right? So, and you know, these are big institutions. They're visible. They're unavoidable, and yet somehow we sort of manage not to know about them, you know. And so, in recent years, when there have been kind of documentaries and books written about them, films written about all this sort of stuff, people purport to be really shocked by it, you know, and it has the force of revelation, but it was all there, you know. And I think this is one of the themes that I thought I might kind of organize the book around, you know, is what we knew, what we didn't know, and most importantly, what we pretended not to know.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm talking with Fintan O'Toole about his book, We Don't Know Ourselves, A Personal History of Modern Ireland. Published originally in 2022 in the United States, it's now out in paperback. Yes, and as I think is clear in many societies, what happens to women is really a microcosm of what happens in general in society. And I mean, I was one of the people who was shocked, and I knew about those homes. But reading it in such detail in your book and the position of women, the things that I really didn't know about, it was maybe not exactly to that extent, but not that different in kind from reading about the Taliban or women in Iran or even in Saudi Arabia. You know, I grew up, I was a child in the 1950s, and you know, women couldn't get credit cards then either, and there were many jobs that women couldn't get. But this lasted, as you say, well into the 90s. But it was more than just affecting women. You make a point that the Catholic Church disabled a society's capacity to think for itself. You twin this treatment of women with the rampant sexual abuse of both boys and girls in the schools, the vast infrastructure of pedophilia. Talk about that concept, that when sexual immorality, you say, is such an unexamined concept, so is sexual morality, everything is beyond the pale of discourse.
Exactly, yeah. So the great tragedy of this is that by fusing church and state in the way that Ireland did, you created a power structure which had no system of accountability. And absolute power corrupts absolutely. It's just, you know. And yes, the worst form of corruption in this was the sexual abuse of children. There's nothing especially Catholic about this, you know, and I'm not making an anti-Catholic point at all here. Any institution or any system where you have men who can do whatever they like and get away with it is going to produce this kind of corruption. And that was certainly the case with the Irish Catholic Church. So the way this worked was that, again, it was sort of open. I remember it as a kid. I mean, I remember at least one teacher that we had who was a religious brother. And this is in high school, you know, this is at the beginning of high school. I mean, he was sort of openly abusing kids every day in class. You know, I mean, in the class.
And your friend confronted him.
Yeah. I mean, I remember one of my friends who was braver than I was, you know, stood up and shouted at him. And just carried on, you know, it just nothing happened. And around where I grew up in the sort of working class housing projects that I grew up in, you know, there were priests who were, I mean, there was one guy who built a swimming pool in his house and said openly that the only people who were allowed to use the swimming pool were prepubescent boys and they could swim naked. You know, this was just sort of, in a way, very open, but nobody knew how to confront it. Nobody knew what the point of confronting it would be, because those who did, so parents of kids who were abused, one of the really awful things about this whole history is that those parents tended to be very apologetic when they approached the church authorities. So first of all, they didn't go to the police in general. They went to the church, and they went to the church almost apologizing for, you know, having the temerity to raise these issues. And what happened over and over again is that the parents were kind of reassured and said, you know, yeah, it's a bit of a problem. We'll deal with it. Don't worry about it. And if it got really bad, what they did was they simply moved the perpetrator, you know, so they moved them from one parish to another, from one school to another, one hospital to another. You know, the children's hospital near where I grew up, you know, the Catholic chaplains, there was a succession of paedophiles. I mean, it wasn't just one, you know. And the authorities knew. I mean, the Archbishop of Dublin, who was one of the most powerful men in the country, knew all this stuff, you know, and did it. So, this was part of this sort of knowing and not knowing and a kind of powerlessness, I suppose, that people felt. And that did produce this notion, really, that you couldn't really confront these abuses or any abuses. You had to sort of live with them and try to find your way around them, which effectively is what most Irish people did. And as you mentioned, Francesca, this is, you know, the overall structure of this, I think, was very much to do with sexual obsession on the part of the church. I mean, the church was absolutely obsessed with sex and with trying to control it. And then it had the support of the state. So contraceptives were banned. I mean, you could not buy contraceptives. You couldn't distribute them. You couldn't advertise them. You couldn't import them. Divorce was banned in the constitution. I mean, it was a constitutional ban on divorce. Abortion, of course, was entirely illegal. Homosexuality, and again, Ireland was not unique in this, but homosexuality was, you know, was punished and stigmatized. But what happens when you sort of try to control sexuality and terrify everybody about sexuality isn't, of course, that there's not sex. It's that, as you mentioned, all sex is bad. It's all sort of evil. And therefore, why is it more evil to be exploiting a child than to be having consensual sex outside of marriage? There was no real way that the church had of saying, look, this kind of sexual relationship is good and that one is bad, you know, for the following reasons, because it was all bad. And the irony is that actually in refusing to think about or talk about healthy sexuality, the church really just promoted the most unhealthy kind of sexuality that you can possibly have. And in the end, destroyed itself. You know, so what happened with this stuff was that over time, the ability to control what people said about it, how people reacted, did diminish. And so as the society changes, as people get more educated, as they get better off, there is a kind of confrontation coming, I suppose, throughout the course of the narrative of the book, you know, where there will be hell to pay. The extraordinary thing maybe is just how long that took. You know, it really took until pretty much the end of the 20th century for this whole system of corruption to come crashing down.
Right, and even into the 21st. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with journalist and critic Fintan O'Toole about his book, We Don't Know Ourselves, A Personal History of Modern Ireland. You know, the flip that you talk about between the old and the new in terms of the attitudes towards sexuality is starkly revealed in two votes. The anti-abortion vote of the 1980s, which enshrined abortion as illegal in the Constitution, and the one that undid it in 2016. Remarkable that the same number of people who voted against abortion in the 1980s voted to undo that constitutional ban in 2016, many of them older people. And this was also, there was also the legalization of gay marriage. You have a wonderful, really beautiful way of explaining how this happened. What was that?
So really what happened was that this cognitive dissonance that we were talking about broke down You know, everybody always knew that Irish women had abortions, right? Because they went to England where it was safe and legal. But the whole system was so riven with hypocrisy, you know, that the idea was not that, you know, that this would be stopped. It was that the women would remain silent. That was what was most important. Don't talk about it. And women didn't. You know, I knew many, many, many women, friends and colleagues, and, you know, and it really wasn't until I was in my 40s, I would say, that I had female friends whom I knew had abortions. You know, so even people I would have known very well just didn't talk about it, didn't say it. So it was wrapped in silence. And the same thing really happened for, well, particularly for gay men. You know, the laws, the British laws under which Oscar Wilde was prosecuted in the 1890s were still on the statute books in Ireland in the 1990s. And of course, they were increasingly unenforced. You know, prosecutions were rare. But again, the point wasn't so much to prosecute people because that was becoming embarrassing. It was to shut them up, to make sure they didn't speak, to make sure that they were ashamed of themselves, that they were kept in this sort of mental space where the reality of their lives didn't have to be acknowledged. And with both of those things, I think this is what flipped, you know, that... It's I think, to do, Francesca, with the idea of intimacy. You know, an intimate society, when it's repressive, is a nightmare because everybody's watching you, you know, and it has that sort of element of surveillance, and then you have to hide things. But if you can keep the intimacy, and it just switches, it turns into something else, which is, well, actually, you know me. I'm your neighbor. I'm your friend. I'm your workmate. I'm your mother, your father, your siblings. And with both of those issues, really, that's what happened. You know, that maybe one of the nice things about our society is that it's still a storytelling society. And people started telling their own stories, particularly women and LGBTQ people did. And it worked. I mean, it sort of transformed everything because, you know, abortion was always treated as symbolic. You know, it was being against abortion and putting it into our constitution and saying we were never going to have abortion. It was not a statement about women's reproductive lives or what really happened to women. It was a statement about what Ireland wanted to be, that it was going to be this exceptionally Catholic place. And refusing to acknowledge the equality of LGBTQ people was the same thing. You know, it was all about sort of maintaining some idea of exceptionalism and purity. And once people, you know, this doesn't happen just by accident. I mean, it takes real courage and real commitment from so many people who, you know, should not have been forced to have to talk about the private aspects of their lives. But they did so. And as they did so, it sort of all melted away. All of the symbolism melted away. It just became, well, you know, this is a human being. This is my neighbor. This is someone who's, you know, belongs in the community. And it was very, very touching, very, very moving to see, I think. And did the rest of us an enormous favor. I think it was the LGBTQ community who broke that silence first, you know, and developed this way of just talking about these issues and talking about their own lives. And I think that in turn gave huge courage to women who'd had abortions, for example, to just talk about why and how and, you know, how it affected their lives and what kinds of choices they made. And so the society did become just much, much more open. And when you have that openness, then intimacy is no longer this sort of toxic idea of, you know, being watched. It actually becomes something about belonging and connecting. And those things, I think, made a very profound change in what it feels like to be in Ireland.
The unknown knowns became known knowns and allowed a kind of integration, I think, of consciousness, where people's ability to think about themselves is restored.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, it's a sort of healthy psychological process, isn't it? I mean, how do you heal from all of this? Trauma is probably not too strong a word to use. You know, there is a historical trauma in Ireland, you know, about mass migration, about poverty, about oppression. And so actually coming to some sort of unified consciousness, I think, you know, is that process of healing. I'm not suggesting for a moment, you know, that Ireland is over everything and that, you know, there are not still problems. There's particular problems, I think, in relation to the violence in Northern Ireland and the spillover of that. And it's still something we haven't really properly dealt with. But I think in general, it's true to say that when you get to a point of saying that, you know, we don't have to be special, we just have to be ourselves, you know, there's a phrase that I use, which actually came from a wonderful woman called Annie Murphy, who was an American woman, actually, who was one of the ones who kind of shattered silences because she had a child with a Catholic bishop, an Irish Catholic bishop. And she told her story in the 1990s. And she was confronted on a big TV show about this, you know, and attacked. And the presenter of the TV program said to her, "Well, if your son is half the man his father was," meaning the bishop, "he won't be too bad." And she got up and she walked off the TV set, live TV, and she said, "I'm not so bad myself." And, you know, it's a very simple phrase, but it sort of really stuck in my head, you know, because actually, you know, what do you want to be as a society? Do you want to think you're perfect and special and better than everybody else? Or do you just want to be not so bad? You know, and I think Ireland now is a lot better for being not so bad.
Fintan O'Toole, stay tuned for more of our conversation after the break. That was Time Dance by Planxty. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Irish journalist, critic, and author Fintan O'Toole about his personal history of modern Ireland, We Don't Know Ourselves. A New York Times bestseller, it was named among the 10 best books of 2022. It's now out in paperback from W.W. Norton. So you mentioned the Troubles, and this was another, you know, real revelation for me. I mean, I was, you know, in the 1960s and 70s, I mean, I was you know, very much in support of the Irish, you know, freedom struggle, which I saw as an anti-imperialist struggle. And I'm not saying that you were against it, but you are, you know, you're very, very brutally honest about the terrible violence of the IRA. You know, we romanticize the IRA. You really don't. And in some ways, it seems like a fascist nationalist movement. Ireland was a victim, but the IRA were victimizers. Talk about that.
Yeah, you know, I grew up with all the mythology of Irish nationalism, all this sort of idea of dying for Ireland, martyrdom, you know, all those things were very, very powerful in the culture. I mean, you mentioned the Taliban earlier, you know, and, you know, there was a lot of stuff in recent years about, you know, suicide bombers and that kind of whole ideology in certain extremes of Islam. But we had that, you know, it was a kind of Catholic martyrdom idea that was very, very potent. So I grew up with all of that. I sang all those songs. I felt all those emotions. And so did most people in the Republic of Ireland, I think. And particularly, say, 1972, when the British Army shot 13 people dead, unarmed protesters dead in the city of Derry. The emotion in the Republic of Ireland was really high. You know, most people actually felt, well, you know, the IRA is justified, and we need to take part in this fighting ourselves. And then the IRA blew it. I mean, they lost the vast bulk of that sympathy from Irish people, because, you know, if it was terrible for the British to kill unarmed civilians, why was it okay for the IRA to do it? Why was it okay for the IRA to put bombs in cafes, in pubs, in hotels, you know, with really no concern at all for innocent civilians? So the process really that happened, I would say, from about 1972 onwards was again another sort of cognitive dissonance in a way. Most people in the Republic of Ireland sort of withdrew mentally from what was happening in the north. You know, we would pay attention when there was a particular atrocity and get angry about the IRA, about the loyalists, the Protestant paramilitaries who committed appalling atrocities, about the British who often themselves were engaged in this violence, but it had to be something kind of pretty big for people to pay attention. And most of the time, even though you're talking about a small island, and even though you're talking about, you know, geographical proximity, that for most Americans would seem, you know, like just next door, there was this kind of disjunction and this mental division, and it was very strange. It was almost surreal, I think, you know, that you had this conflict going on, but a capacity for most people on the island to pretty much ignore it most of the time and just hope it was going to go away. So, you know, people don't get that. I think that for the vast bulk of the time of the Troubles, the support for the IRA among Catholic nationalists, you know, from people of my background, was actually pretty minimal. I would say no more than 10%, and at sometimes after terrible atrocities, a lot less than that.
So one thing we haven't talked about yet, Fintan O'Toole, that you go into in fascinating detail in this book, We Don't Know Ourselves, is the whole way in which Ireland did modernize economically. And, you know, here again, it's a tale of unknown knowns. There's a huge amount of corruption that is connected with it. Again, the church and state are together. You talk a lot about, and I'm not sure how to pronounce the name of the Taoiseach, is that how you pronounce?
It's called Taoiseach, yeah, which is the Irish for prime minister, basically.
The Taoiseach Howie?
Hawhey.
Taoiseach Hawhey.
Yes.
Yes, tell us about this. I mean, he presided over this development, but also the development of offshore tax havens.
Yeah, so what happens at the end of the 1950s is that there's this huge change in government policy. So because of nationalism, the Irish governments had been trying to, you know, keep out foreign investment. You know, the idea that we would develop all our own industries and we would be self-sufficient. I mean, that was really the mantra. In fairness, I mean, a lot of governments started doing this in, you know, in the 20s and 30s, so, you know, a lot of protectionism But it just didn't work because Ireland was too small. You can't really develop your industries or your own markets if your market's leaving. And a lot of the Irish, you know, the markets was going elsewhere. People were emigrating. So there was this kind of vicious circle, really, that, you know, the industry couldn't really develop because people were emigrating, and people were emigrating because the industry hadn't developed. So something had to be done to just break this cycle. And what was done was to offer very generous tax incentives to foreign companies to come and invest in Ireland. And this proved to be pretty successful in the 1960s and 1970s. Particularly American companies, and particularly after Ireland joined the European Union in 1973. So it's pretty attractive. If you were an American corporation, you could set up in Ireland. You had a good workforce. Wages were still relatively cheap. And then you had full access to the European market from Ireland, you know, so it was quite a good deal. And then you paid low taxes. So the corporation tax rate settled at 12.5%, you know, which is an awful lot cheaper than paying taxes in the US, for, you know. So this model really, you know, has been the one that has driven really all of this change in Ireland. So it's what leads people to move from agriculture into industry, to move from the countryside into the towns and cities. It starts bringing with it much, you know, higher demand for education. As you move up the industrial food chain, companies want educated workers. They don't just want somebody who's going to work on an assembly line. So it's highly successful for the most part. But it again has a sort of odd effect, right? Which is, I don't think there's another country anywhere or ever has been one that has developed almost entirely through external investment, you know. And what it does is it kind of creates these two worlds. So you have this world of hyper-capitalism, hyper-globalization. So Ireland becomes, as it is now, the European hub for most American IT companies, most American pharmaceutical companies, and most American medical technology companies. They're all in Ireland. By the 1990s, you have this sort of comic reality that you still have this very Catholic country where all the Viagra in the world is made and all the Botox in the world. So it sort of creates this sort of slightly surreal feel to the place, you know, which is that this technology, high technology, lands on it like it's from outer space. And Ireland still has a little, there's still some sense of that, you know. But one of the effects of this is that it allows the indigenous politicians, and particularly you mentioned this character whom I write about quite a lot, Charles Haughey, who was prime minister for a lot of the 80s and 90s. And a dominant figure even from the 1960s onwards. But it allowed them to indulge in really quite flagrant corruption because they didn't mess with the multinationals, right? So they weren't looking for bribes from Pfizer or Intel, right? You know, they knew you don't do that, right? But you had this sort of other economy, this indigenous economy, where they could indulge themselves really in all of this sort of stuff, because the multinational engine just kept running and running and running, really under its own steam. So the rest of the economy they sort of saw as fair game for corruption, particularly the two big sectors of this kind of native economy, if you like, were banking and property. You know, property development, construction, all that sort of stuff, and these became completely intertwined. Haughey, this prime minister, was always taking money from property developers, and they in turn got sort of tax incentives, tax breaks, like, you know, lots of help from government. But it infected the banking industry to an extraordinary extent. So by the early part of the 21st century, the Irish banking system is, pouring vast amounts of money into it, just utterly inflated property development. Again, something like this happens in other countries. Of course, a lot of it happens in America. But it's the sheer extent of it meant that when that the great sort of crash came in 2008, the great banking crash globally, I mean, Ireland was just affected by it more than anybody else. I think Irish taxpayers ended up paying 40% of the cost of the bank bailouts in Europe. Now, Ireland is 1% of the population of Europe. So we had these kind of very, very corrupt banks, aided by politicians who often themselves were corrupt. So it was like, again, living in these two worlds, where you've got these leading edge, highly technologically sophisticated American multinational corporations on the one side, and you've got this kind of casino capitalism on the other side, which is sort of native industry. And it made the place feel quite strange.
And massive non-payment of taxes.
Yeah, so in the 80s, particularly, 80s was a terrible, terrible decade. It was awful. You had a big Catholic reaction, backlash in the 1980s. You mentioned earlier putting a ban on abortion into the Constitution, which was insane, given that abortion was already completely illegal. You had sort of real turn back towards the sort of conservative Catholicism. You had the troubles in Northern Ireland, continuing at an awful level. And then you had this kind of huge economic downturn. So mass immigration started up again. And one of the things that characterized that period was this sort of massive tax evasion by ordinary businesses. This wasn't just sort of very high level stuff that was going on. The banks were very much engaged in colluding with their customers. We're talking about the bar keep, the local shop, the farmers. Banks were colluding with all of those to essentially defraud the taxation system, and the state knew about this and really did nothing about it. So this sort of, again, people knew about this. It was kind of open in a way, and pretending not to know it, but it disillusioned a lot of people. I mean, it really made a lot of compliant taxpayers and good citizens feel really angry about the way the place was functioning, and that I think also maybe contributed to things like mass emigration. I mean, a lot of people left because they just were fed up with the way the place was functioning.
Yeah, I remember those times. I live in East Hampton, New York, and I remember all of a sudden in the 1980s, almost everybody who worked in the tourist trade in the summer was Irish.
Yes.
And, finally, I found your discussion of this deeply corrupt right-wing authoritarian government, this almost theocracy, the discussion of the whole anti-abortion repression, anti-gay laws, anti-divorce laws. While I was reading that, I read it as passed as prologue to the contemporary United States. Now, you divide your time between Ireland and the U.S. You teach in Princeton. What do you make of this? What's happening here in this country? Do you contrast it to the Ireland you used to know? And just what are your thoughts on this? What's your reaction?
There were very, very good reasons why the founders of the United States separated church from state. They knew what they were doing. They understood, because, of course, this was the common experience of Europe, how toxic it is when you fuse religion and politics, when you fuse the power of the church and the power of the state. It inevitably ends up being repressive. And so I think they also understood that it wasn't just bad for the state and for democracy, it was bad for religion. You know, actually, religion gets completely corrupted when it becomes a form of political power. And it is horrifying for me to see that there are forces in the United States currently who want to go back to the very thing that the United States was founded to get away from, you know, which is that fusion of politics and religion, you know, to effectively try to make the United States into not the sort of open pluralist democracy that it ought to be, but into one in which theology effectively and religious doctrine is made state law and is enforced by the state. And of course, abortion is the leading edge of this, but it is only the leading edge. You know, it's used as a wedge issue, but we know that it's part of a package, you know, which goes with contraception, which goes with attacks on LGBTQ people, which goes with attempts to control and repress women's sexuality, women's choices. I mean, we know from history, you know, that's what the package is, and anybody would be very foolish, I think, to think that it stops with abortion. It certainly doesn't, and it's sort of ironic, I think, coming from a country where we had all that stuff, where we saw how toxic it was and gradually escaped from it. You know, we've come out the other side of it. Ireland isn't sort of wise because we're the smartest people in the world. We're wise because we've done all the wrong things and have to learn from them, you know. And, you know, having grown up in something pretty like a theocracy, my strong advice to Americans would be, you don't want to go there. You really don't want it. You don't want it if you are a Democrat. You know, if you believe that citizenship is something to which people are entitled, regardless of their ethnicity or their faith or their gender or their sexual identity. But you also don't want it actually if you're a religious person. You know, nothing will corrupt religion and genuine religious faith more than its weaponization as a form of political control and political power. It ceases to be religion and it becomes something else. So I would very strongly urge even people who, you know, for religious reasons are tempted to think about wanting the state to impose their particular brand of religion on everybody else, to think twice about it, actually. Look at what's happened to the Catholic Church in Ireland. It was one of the strongest religious institutions the world has ever seen. And it was that up to about 20 years ago. And now it's gone. You know, there's only a minority of people in Ireland now are practicing Catholics. You know, and it's entirely its own fault. You know, it did this to itself, and it did it because it became too powerful, and that power corrupted it. And ultimately, that corruption leads to a loss of authority, a loss of connection to ordinary people, and ordinary people vote with their feet. You know, they withdraw from what they see as corrupted forms of power.
Mm. Wise words and a cautionary tale. This is just such an amazing book, a wonderful read, beautifully written. We don't know ourselves, a personal history of modern Ireland. Fintan O'Toole, it has been a privilege to speak with you. Thank you so much.
I really enjoyed it, Francesca. Thank you.
Here's an excerpt from a poem by the late, great Irish poet Seamus Heaney that echoes what Fintan O'Toole said about the unknown knowns. It's called, "Whatever You Say, Say Nothing." Let's listen to a stanza from the poem read by the poet.
Religion's never mentioned here, of course. You know them by their eyes and hold your tongue. One side's as bad as the other, never worse. Of the wee six I sing, where to be saved, you only must save face. And whatever you say nothing. Smoke signals are loudmouthed compared with us. Maneuverings to find out name and school, with subtle discrimination by addresses, with hardly an exception to the rule that Norman, Ken and Sydney signaled prod, and Seamus, call me Sean, were surefire pape. O land of password, hand grip, wink and nod, of open minds as open as a trap, where tongues lie coiled as under flame lie wicks, where half of us, as in a wooden horse, were cabined and confined like wily Greeks, besieged within the siege, whispering Morse.
Seamus Heaney reading from his poem, Whatever You Say, Say Nothing. Go to writersvoice.net to read the whole poem. And finally, during the 1960s hippie heyday of Big Sur, California, the storyteller Susan Porter recorded an album of stories from Irish mythology. My father, Guido Tennyson, lived on Porter's property in a house on a promontory overlooking the Pacific Ocean. Back in the day, he sent me a cassette tape of Porter's album. Here's a clip from the story of Cahulain, read by Porter. The audio quality is faded, but I think that only adds to its air of mystery.
I shall tell you the story, the only son of Cahulain. When Cahulain of Muirhebne was still but a youth, and the down on his cheek was soft and sparkled in the sunlight, so great were his strength and his skill and his courage that he had already made glorious his title of the Hound of Ulster. And that he might be still more perfect in the art of war, Conor the King sent him unto Skaia, a great warrior woman, to eastward, that he might learn of her the strange battle feats of which she alone held the secret. And through many perils, the peril of the fiery marsh, and the peril of the shrinking bridge, the lad Cahulain made his way to Skaia's country, to that misty, rocky island, which in memory of a name long forgotten, men still call the Isle of Skye. And there he sought her, and they found her, the black-browed queen, where she stood beneath an apple tree, teaching her two young sons to cast the spear. And Cahulain placed his sword's point at her throat, and he vowed he would slay her, unless she promised straightway to take him as her pupil. And Skaia laughed for joy at the light she saw in his eyes. And she bade him enter into her household and join himself to the young princes and heroes that were there to learn of her. And such were his strength and his skill and his courage that he soon surpassed them all. And he learned all Skaia had to teach him. The sword feat he learned, the dark feet, the apple feet, the needle feet, the blind feet, the feet of the champion's breath, the feet of the leaf to the sword point, the strange and terrible feet at the ford.
Susan Porter, storyteller of Big Sur, reading the story of Cahulain. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.